I call the meeting of the Energy Finance and Policy Committee to order. Today is Thursday, March 5th, 2026. A quorum is present. Representative Weiner, would you like to move the minutes from March 3rd? All right, Representative Weiner moves the March 3rd minutes. Are there any additions or corrections to the minutes? Seeing none, all those, yes, Madam, Representative Hollins.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I see on the minutes, Representative Kraft assumed the gavel at X. Is that a mistake, or is that how we typically do that?
We will double check that timing.
Maybe it's a Roman numeral.
That's right. I believe the assumption of the gavel happened. We will double check that, and we will amend. We'll take that back up. We'll do a little quick research.
I'm fairly sure it was at Y, not at X.
All right. Chromosomes aside. Anyway. All right. Any other discussion to the minutes? All right. We will do a little look at that. And all in favor of approving the minutes as corrected, say aye.
Aye.
All opposed? All right. There we go. The first bill on the agenda is House File 3296. Representative Mecklen, would you like to move House File 3296 for Representative Gilman as she comes up to the stand? Representative Mecklen. What's
that? Thank you, Mr. Chair. I would.
Oh, yeah.
What are we doing with this one?
Oh, just move the bill, Representative
Mecklen.
I'd like
to move House File 3296, Mr. Chair.
All right. Thank you. Representative Mecklen moves House File 3296. Representative Mecklen moves that House File 3296 be put before the committee. Representative Gilman, do you have any amendments or anything that you'd like to discuss really quickly that might be on your bill, or talk about your bill, to your bill?
Thank you, Chair Swidinski. I do have an author's amendment, and there also is a DE as well.
All right. I move the DE amendment for Representative Gilman to get in the bill in the shape that she would like. All in favor, say aye.
Aye.
All opposed, say nay. The ayes have it. Representative Gilman, to your bill as amended.
Wonderful. Thank you so much. Thanks for having me today. So the issue addressed in House File 3296 as amended was first brought to my attention toward the end of the 2025 legislative session by a constituent, Dave Meyer of Glencoe, Minnesota. He works for Glencoe Light and Power. And again, Glencoe is in the heartbeat of my district, and so I'm happy he's here today. So Glencoe is home to one of, if not the first, crypto-based data mining center operations in the state. While working with this data mining company, Glencoe quickly realized that the electrical load of the operation could rival that the utility's entire remaining, it could use up the remaining base load. While able and willing to serve the operation, the one challenge that concerned the utility was the impact such a massive load would have on the efficiency, conservation, and optimization plan, the ECHO plan. A municipal utility such as Glencoe is required to find usage offsets equal to at least 1.5% of their gross annual retail sales of electricity, with a finite number of options as to how to find sufficient offsets. Adding 1.5% of sales to the data mining operation was not a very feasible option. Therefore, in 2024, the legislature carved out a limited exemption from counting electric sales to crypto-based data mining operations if said operation increased the utility's baseload by 40% or more. Now, a similar issue has arisen and on an even more extreme scale regarding data centers. House File 3296 simply seeks to extend the same exemption from the calculating of gross annual sales to data centers as is currently provided to crypto-based data mining. The threshold remains at an increase of 40% or more to the base sales. The ECHO goal for subjected sales remains 1.5%. The definition of data center is consistent with the use of term in Data Center Act approved by this body in the first special session of 2025. The bill simply provides a common sense relief protecting utilities from ultimately being penalized for not being able to meet an unattainable goal. If Minnesota wants to remain a leader in technology, such as AI, passing House File 3296 is critically important. Now I'd like to turn things over to my testifier, who will further clarify and demonstrate the need to approve House File 3296.
All right, if you have testifiers there, if you want to introduce yourself to the committee, and we'd look forward to hearing from your testimony.
Certainly. As indicated, my name is David Meyer. I'm the general manager for the Glencoe Light and Power Commission in Glencoe, Minnesota. Glencoe Light and Power was fortunate a few years ago to have a crypto mining operation seek service in our service territory. It's gone really well, but one of the problems that we noticed right away is that the CIP program, as it started out back in the 80s, the Conservation Improvement Program, has evolved to the ECO program. In the ECO program, a utility like ours and any other utility in the state needs to show savings of kilowatt hours in the amount of 1.5% of your gross sales in the previous average of the 3 years. In Glencoe's case, that 1.5%, I'm rounding some numbers just because I have exacts, but I just want to round them. In Glencoe's case, our native load uses approximately 80 million kilowatt hours of energy a year, or sells approximately 80 million kilowatt hours. I realize that these numbers may or may not mean a lot to people, but the numbers will. With that 80 million, that means that each year we need to show savings of 1.2 million kilowatt hours in any given year, and we have to do that every year. By adding this crypto mining operation, that number changes from 1.2 million to 3.1 million because of the volume of sales to the crypto operation. So we have 2,944 customers, and we can utilize the savings that they see from our programs to save 1.2 million customers, or if we add one more customer, it goes to 3.1 million kilowatt hours. That's where the problem lies, and that's why we seek to have this language put in here.
All right, thank you, Mr. Miner. Do you have any other testifiers before, if you want to introduce yourself to the committee?
Chair Szczesny, members of the committee. I'm Ken Sulem, Director of Government Relations and Senior Counsel for the Minnesota Municipal Utilities Association, and we wanted to thank Representative Gilman for bringing this bill. And just to reassure everybody that it is a tightly drafted bill that's intended to deal with the situations that are the getcha in between type data centers that are out there. They're too small to get all the reliefs that are covered in other legislation, but they're causing enough problems for the local communities that we need some help, and that's why this bill came before you. That I'll just be here for any questions.
All right. Are there any questions for the testifiers? All right. We also have, thank you. If just stick close in case anyone does have a question for you. We also have Sarah Wolf in hand if you want to come to the testifying table. And please introduce yourself to the committee and grab a chair, and we'd like to hear from you.
Good afternoon, Chair Swidzinski, Co-Chair Acom, members of the community committee, Representative Gilman, and thank you so much. I'd like to say my name is Sarah Wolf, and I'm with Minnesota Interfaith Power and Light, and I do not do the excellent job of providing electric service to the utility that the Glencoe Light and Power does. So thank you for the work you do. Thank you for the work you do also to help your customers find those efficiencies with that eco goal every year. I know that's a lot, and that saves your customers' money. So thanks for that work. We've all learned a lot in the last year about data centers and the impact they are having on our grid and our electricity demand. And I just wanted to offer that in this moment of rising electric rates and growing demand, efficiency measures like those asked of in ECO do and can play even more a really significant role in both A, saving consumers money, and B, creating capacity on the grid. So for instance, replacing an inefficient electric resistance heating system with a highly efficient air source heat pump does both of those things. A Rewiring America analysis shows that this kind of home improvement, which would then both heat a home and cool a home, would save the homeowner $1,975 on average a year in electricity costs. That's how much electricity it saves. So today is exactly the time to be doubling down on finding these efficiencies, especially because we face the growing electricity demand from data centers and the new challenges to grid stability that this brings. The exemption rationale that we've had, perhaps pertinent to these other large facilities because they had little scope to reduce their energy, isn't as applicable when we see our homes not just as consumers, but as active participants in resilient energy infrastructure. And entities like data centers that do and will need so much from this infrastructure should be adding to and not detracting from these efforts in all the ways that are possible. So thank you so much for this opportunity to share this with you today.
All right, thank you. Are there any more questions? Any folks from the public that would like to make a comment on House File 3296 as amended? You know, I maybe have a general question. Mr. Meyer, would you want to come back to the stand?
Yes, sir.
Yes, thank you, Mr. Meyer. Just kind of a general question. So, you know, as the testifying, you know, was stated that, you know, obviously SIP does some work when it comes to energy efficiency. In your discussions with developers and some of the discussions around that, is there a lot of efficiencies that you'll be able to find with a potential site like this, whether it's a data center or a crypto mining facility? Do they seem like there's a lot of room for efficiencies within the current SIP mandates?
No, unfortunately, that's what creates the problem, is that data centers, crypto mining, anything like that, their most expensive commodity is the electricity they consume. So they tend to build their facilities right out of the gate as efficient as they can. So we can't really go after efficiencies there, which makes it really difficult to try and find that savings.
Mm-hmm. Sounds good. So Mr. Meyer, would you say that, so if you have a large user, which sometimes is as big as the rest of your grid, so if you're maintaining, like you said, what was it, 80,000?
80 million.
80 million, and your estimation was that it would be doubling that potentially, or what would it be from a
actually load? Actually, in our case, it's more than that.
Yeah.
The provisions in the bill indicate that the facility has to increase your demand by over 40% of your native load, if you will. In our case, our native load is approximately 75 to 80 million kilowatt hours. This facility uses 146 million.
Mm-hmm.
So it literally takes our town and makes it three times as big in consumption.
Certainly, certainly. And so, you know, as those, just as talks have happened, as those conversations are happening with that increased load, you know, are there, how will that operate? So as you're selling more electricity within your service territory, will that help with maintaining? So if you have a single large user, a large industrial user, whatever that might be, will that help maintain the rest of the grid, so for grid sustainability throughout the rest of the grid, so like the maintenance and the things, will that allow you to potentially have more resources that will help lower the cost for other ratepayers when it comes to kind of that that maintenance and upkeep and buying new transmission and poles and things like that?
Absolutely. In our case, our Board of Commissioners and myself, before we ever brought this customer in, we made a promise to ourselves that it would never adversely affect our native load. So it has not. And the revenue stream from this additional facility, we've actually utilized that to decrease rates for our customers, for the rest of our customers.
Sounds good. What percentage, what ability have you been, like, do you have some numbers there in your ability to decrease rates for the rest of your customers?
So we calculate a power cost adjustment each month as a practice, where we literally take our cost of energy and our total energy purchased and calculate how much that energy cost us. What we do right now is take that cost of energy, and instead of using that whole value as compared to the energy sold or energy purchased to come up with that cost of that power cost adjustment, we actually artificially buy down that power cost adjustment by $40,000. So if you buy X amount of kilowatt hours at $300,000, instead of dividing by 300,000, we're dividing by 260. So we've been doing that since this facility came on board. So it has lowered costs. The revenues from this facility have assisted in lowering costs for all of our customers.
Sounds good. Have you, thank you, Mr. Meyer. Have you done any calculations? So you did kind of in that micro, that little snapshot, have you kind of done a total cost savings from by you know, having, you know, the benefit of having a large user like this within your jurisdiction, like what has been that total savings over time since they've been in operation?
I have not done a full calculation of the total savings.
Okay, sounds good. Sounds like we may have some other questions. Representative Akam?
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Chair Akam, sorry.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And thank you, Representative Gilman. Welcome to committee.
Thank you.
And to the testifier, I just have a couple of questions. I know crypto can sometimes be somewhat of a transient operation. Is there a long-term contract with this particular customer?
Mr. Meyer.
Yes, ma'am. We entered into a three-year agreement that's been extended another 3 years. Obviously, there's off-ramp provisions. In our case, the customer has been a stable customer, and quite frankly, right now, we're looking at the possibility of expanding from crypto. They have a desire to expand into AI, and we are exploring those options right now.
Great. Thank you.
Representative Akam.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I will just say that you know, I worked hard on the data center bill, as did many last year, and we built in an exemption for the hyperscale data centers, similar to large industrial users, in part because of the benefit, the community benefit program that we built into the data center package. And so that community benefit program, which provides weatherization and energy efficiency based on what size of data center that there is, back into the state. So recognizing that overall energy efficiency is an important goal that we need to be working on and continuing to improve, that at the time when maybe generation or the need, demand, because of data centers or crypto, is adding more draw or more load, we want to make sure we're offsetting that by energy efficiency within the state. So I have some concerns because of the impact of that, recognizing why we did it for the larger industrial customers, that, you know, maybe there needs to be some sort of a balancing on the other side. And I, there's also I guess I'm just learning, I was getting a little information that some some large users that are over 20 megawatts can apply for an exemption already, which maybe that needs to be looked at rather than what we're proposing here. So I think that I have some concerns about some of it. I think this is going to be laid over, so I think there's some opportunities to continue to work on this. And so those are just some of my comments for now.
Sounds good. I don't think there's a question there. Mr. Meyer, do you have a reply to that? Or,
As a matter of fact, I do. The issue of the 20-megawatt number that you've indicated, that's been around for a long time. The problem we run into here is that Glencoe's native load, its whole native load is only 20 megawatts. Some of my colleagues that are looking at bringing in facilities like this, their whole town might have a 10-megawatt load. They might look to add a 10-megawatt data center, which will triple their energy consumption and triple their conservation improvement program requirement, then not get anywhere near that 20-megawatt number. That 20 megawatt number is significant for a large utility that has extremely large industries coming in, but we're looking at an incremental impact on a smaller utility. And that's where the concerns came from.
Representative Acom. Representative Murphy.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just to go a little bit more off of the, you know, the savings to your customers, when you do that, is it costing you any more to do that, or are you still able to come out about the same in terms of your profitability?
As far as meeting the savings?
Yes. Mr. Meyer?
Yeah, by giving savings on that bill to customers.
Mr. Meyer.
So our requirement is to show energy conservation in the amount of 1.5% of the consumption. The way we do that is by doing rebates. Every time we pay a customer a rebate, that's how we prove that energy was saved. In simple terms, if you go buy a 10-watt LED light bulb to replace your 100-watt, and we give you a rebate on that light bulb, we just saved 90 watts of electricity. So every measure that our customers use in energy efficiency where they apply for rebates, we use those numbers to calculate out and show how much savings we've created and how much we've saved our customers. The inherent problem with this is with a customer of the scale of a crypto miner or a data center that has a high load factor, which means they're using electricity 24/7 all the time, that goal of instead of saving $1.2 million a year and changing it to $3.1 a year is quite frankly unattainable, because the next year you have to do it again, and the next year you have to do it again. So I don't know if that answers your question all the way, but it's a complicated issue. I've only been dealing with it for, I don't know, 36 years.
No.
Representative Murphy.
I guess the thing I was getting at is, you know, you mentioned that there was some kind of monthly adjustment. I was just wondering, as a percentage, what does it look like? Just to give us a little bit understanding how this could all work. So as a percentage on your monthly bill, what have you seen? You said it went down a little bit. What is an estimate of that percentage?
Mr. Meyer.
Buying down the power cost adjustment by that $40,000 each month, probably a half a cent a kilowatt hour per customer, and at an 8 cent base rate, so a half a cent on 8 cents.
Great, thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you,
Representative Kraft.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and welcome, Representative Gilman. Excuse me.
Thank you.
A few questions. First. Did you say your base load or your native load is 20 megawatts? So that, but you also said you had 80 megawatts. Can you tell me, describe that number?
So in the electrical world, there's your demand, your capacity, and it's the energy you consume. So our peak demand on our system, at its highest point, it is drawing 20 megawatts of power from the grid. The culmination over time of that energy is where you come up with the 80 million kilowatt hours per year.
Got it. Okay.
Representative Kraft.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Appreciate that. So you also mentioned that you have a three-year contract with this. In the context of a load that seems to dwarf the amount of energy that you sell to non-data center customers, that doesn't seem like a very long time to me. I mean, you know, if they were to go away in 3 years and you've set up an infrastructure to support them, won't that hurt you?
Mr. Meyer.
In our case, the cost of building off the infrastructure was borne by the customer.
Representative Kraft.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Okay, that makes, okay, kudos to you, makes a lot of sense. Here's my concern, I guess. I certainly understand your issue of this load dwarfing your other load and where do you find energy efficiency opportunities. But can't data centers get more energy efficient over time?
Mr. Meyer.
Quite frankly, in working with our data center, they are so in tune to their energy costs that they've implemented every efficiency measure that they can. They have variable frequency drives on all of their fans. They are turning things down when they can. Literally, there is, if there's a savings, an energy savings to be found in their facility, we haven't found any more.
Representative Kraft.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. In a prior life, I used to sell into data centers or people. So I have no doubt that you're correct in terms of backward looking into when they put it in. But data center technology has been changing and growing. And you're right, like energy is such a huge focus for them. They are going to continue to try to squeeze out everything they can. And I've seen data centers over time swap out CPUs, change their cooling approaches, all kinds of things. So my concern with this is saying, okay, you've done what you can, and we're not going to ask you to do any more when we're asking others to do more. So that's my concern, is that I think we should still be requiring these folks, as technology progresses, to continue to try to create energy efficiency in their operations. Thank you.
Thank you. Now, I can just comment to that, too, Representative Kraft. You know, I think there are different technologies that use different amounts of energy. You know, if this body wanted to pass a law so that data centers would use less energy, they would ask them to use open water cooling systems. So they would either draw from the ground or use open water system. If you wanted to use less electricity off the bat, those technologies do that. What uses more energy is closed loop systems, but they don't use water. So there's always that trade-off. So you have either a chilling system that uses refrigerant from a water, you know, a water closed loop system, which is maybe less water but more energy. And then you have the other side, which would be maybe using groundwater or river water that would potentially use less energy because you're not using chillers, you're using ambient temperature water throughout the year. That changes the dynamic on how much energy is used. So there are technologies. And from, you know, you talked a little bit about it from a CPU standpoint. You know, depending on what type of technology is being used within the industry, whether it's a crypto or whether it's a data, you know, that technology is changing quite drastically. And that's why the sales tax, this is obviously not tax committee, but that's why the sales tax exemption was so important to pass last year, is because of the oftentimes how the data centers re-up and refill. So essentially they gut their data center every, I think it's 3 or 5 or 8 years. They take all the equipment out and replace it with new upgraded modern facilities, and that's super important. But, you know, that's not necessarily this bill, and it would be hard to track that. And I think what they're trying to do is understanding what that baseload is of that data center so that those costs aren't being borne for kids. Because it is a cost. You know, that 1.5% SIP mandate is a cost across the board to ratepayers. And, you know, as we're looking to drive down the cost of electricity, that's 1.5% that they're having to spend to find technology to give rebates, to spend in areas that if we took away that would also potentially allow other dollars to be kept in people's pockets and not redeployed into other assets. Representative Kraft.
Mr. Chair, well, one, I think you made my point for me, because you talked about them swapping out CPUs every 5 to 8 years to increase efficiency. You know, they are going to keep working on it, regardless of the starting point, whether it's water-cooled or air-cooled, or as you talk about. I'm not debating that. We can talk about water and air and the other impacts there, but I'm talking about, shouldn't we be wanting them to get more energy efficient? And then your point about cost, well, I mean, energy efficiency is doing more with less. So the focus behind that is to lower costs over time. Thank you.
Thank you. All right. Any other questions for the testifiers? Any questions for Representative Gilman? All right. We also just want to thank you guys for coming before the committee. I think we're ready to go. Representative Gilman, thank you. The bill is laid on the table.
Awesome. Thanks.
No, laid over. Sorry.
Okay, I was like, laid over.
All right, thank you. EdX. Yeah, we're working on that. All right. Sounds good. So, all right. So, next item of business is a presentation about reliability from the Midwest Reliability Organization. Sorry. We have Will Seifert and Mark Timier. I know I butchered that up. Joining us today. Welcome to the committee. Please identify yourselves for the record, and we look forward to hearing from you. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Can everybody see?
Okay.
Great. Well, good afternoon. For the record, my name is Will Seifert. I'm the Director of Regulatory Affairs at the Midwest Reliability Organization. It is nice to be back here visiting with the House. I spent about 20 years in different roles in Minnesota state government, most recently as the Executive Secretary of the Public Utilities Commission. So I really do value your time here and dedicating so much time to the topic of reliability today. So thank you for that. I'll turn it over to my colleague to introduce himself.
Yes, thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chair. So my name is Mark Timier, and I'm the Director of Power System Risk Management at the MRO. And so my role is to create a top-down, holistic risk management program that identifies, prioritizes, and then also identifies solutions to address bulk power system reliability and security risks.
All right. To your presentation.
All right. Thank you. So I'm going to talk a little bit. I want to spend a couple minutes just presenting a little bit about what MRO is, and we're a resource to you all here in the work that you do, and I want to make sure that you understand how we're structured and where we fit into the space. And then Mr. Timier is going to speak about risk in the Midwest region and in our footprint. But our story and really the structure for regulating reliability on the power grid dates back to 2003. And so the Northeast blackout in 2003 impacted about 50 million people from New York City to Toronto across eight states, with an economic impact upwards, if not exceeding, $10 billion. Congress acted in 2005 and passed the Energy Policy Act. One of the key features of that legislation was it gave FERC the authority to enforce mandatory reliability standards on the grid. These existed in some voluntary capacity before them, but this legislation created a mandatory regulatory scheme. FERC then designated the North American Electric Reliability Corporation, NERC, as the ERO, the Electric Reliability Organization. So NERC assumed authority for developing standards. And then 1 year later, NERC delegated to, at the time there were eight regions, and now through some consolidation there are six regions, to regional entities, MRO being one of them, to monitor and oversee and ensure compliance with those standards. So that's how we came to be. We refer to ourselves as the ERO Enterprise. That's NERC and the six regions. And we have entered into agreements with the governments of Canada and Mexico to ensure compliance with these standards as well. So a little bit about MRO. I start here with our mission, but really it comes down to mitigation of risks to reliability and security. We exist for the purpose of reliability and security. And I want to emphasize that because I recognize your work is bigger than that. You have a lot of things to balance. You have to balance reliability with affordability, with sustainability, with community impacts, with other constituent concerns, other laws that you've passed over the years. We have the luxury of just kind of speaking to that one leg of the stool, which is reliability. So I just wanted to offer that context to our presentation today. We are a nonprofit company. We are not part of the government. We do, however, have regulatory authorities that are rooted in federal law. This is handed down to us through a delegation agreement with NERC that is approved by the Federal Energy Regulatory Commission. Our office is just down the road in St. Paul, and we have about 80 employees, mostly with similar backgrounds to my colleague here, Mr. Timier. So this is our footprint here. We oversee about 250 utility companies that span from Saskatchewan and Manitoba down to northern parts of Texas. As you can see, our boundaries don't neatly align with political boundaries, nor do they align with RTO boundaries. They are where the physical assets of the entities that we oversee are located. About 27 million people rely on power in this region. And this is just a look at kind of where our scope is, right? We're focused on regional and national grid security of the bulk power system. And when I refer to the bulk power system or the bulk electric system, that is everything that is over 100 kV. So this is generation resources, high voltage transmission lines, and major substations. When you step down the voltage underneath 100 kV, then you're talking about the distribution system, which falls exclusively under the purview of state and provincial policymakers and regulators. What I really like about this slide, though, is it reinforces that reliability is a team sport. Your constituents don't care if they lose power because of a down tree on a distribution line or a cascading event on the bulk power system. So we want to be a resource to you all as you make decisions and do your work as it pertains to reliability, because these impacts certainly are connected and ultimately impact your constituents. So I noted a little bit our kind of our regulatory structure that's in these top two lines here: registration, certification, and compliance monitoring enforcement. So this is with what we call registered entities, but these are the generation owners and operators, transmission owners and operators, and RTOs within the footprint. We also do system assessment and performance analysis. So the Federal Power Act requires the ERO to perform analyses of the resources and the adequacy of the resources on the grid. We comply with this requirement through the publication of a long-term reliability assessment and then seasonal risk assessments at the beginning of the summer and winter every year. My colleague Mark's going to talk about our risk identification and mitigation work. But before I hand it over to him, I also just wanted to call out critical infrastructure security. I know we don't spend a lot of time talking about cyber and physical security, but this is a big piece of what we do. We are part of the EISAC, which is an International Electricity Information Sharing and Analysis Center. We convene a weekly threat call, which almost functions as a regional EISAC, if you will, and has tremendous value to the smaller utilities that are in our footprint who have an opportunity to learn from those that have more resources to monitor and share information pertaining to ongoing threats to security, physical and cyber. So I will turn it over now to my colleague, Mark, to talk about risk in the region.
Mr. Tiemeyer.
Yes, thank you very much, Chair. MRO conducts a regional risk assessment, and which becomes the foundation of our work to identify and prioritize risks to the reliability and security of the bulk power system. And so each year we analyze technical studies, performance data, and also inputs from across our 16 U.S. states and two Canadian provinces to ultimately determine the most significant risks to our region. And once we prioritize those risks, we translate those into recommended actions. And as Will mentioned, reliability being a team sport, it does require coordinated actions from regulators, policymakers, grid operators, utilities, and as well generators. RRA actually just got published in the middle of February. Our latest RRA, I should say, just got published in the middle of February. If you go to the next slide, Will. And here's kind of what we have identified for the 2026 regional risk assessment. We've identified seven top regional risks. Most of these risks have carried over from prior years, but we did actually add a new high priority risk this year around the availability of materials and equipment for grid transformation. But for the third consecutive year, we have identified the top and only extreme risk within our region to be whether we can supply enough energy to meet rapidly growing demand. And as you all are well aware, our grid is undergoing a historic change. Demand is accelerating, dispatchable generation is retiring, and we have an increased reliance on wind and solar generation. And that wind and solar generation relies upon what we call inverter-based technologies. And these resources behave in a much different way than the traditional resources of the past do. They require a lot more accurate modeling as well as sophisticated controls to perform reliably during grid disturbances. And at the same time, we're also increasing our reliance on natural gas generation. And this introduces a new fuel diversity risk for the grid, especially when you think about the extreme cold weather that gets subjected to this region. We found that winterization challenges throughout our generation fleet, as well as fuel constraints, have increased our outage risk during those severe weather events. And then lastly, just to go back to that security topic, our regional risk assessment also has identified a trio of high-priority risks related to grid security. Geopolitical tensions are increasing, and of course the North American grid is an attractive target, specifically for nation-state actors. And then the threat landscape continues to evolve as our industry relies more upon a more increasingly complex supply chain, especially for, again, that critical control equipment, which is hardware and software. And we can also see a compromise of one of those hardware or software vendors have cascading impacts across multiple utilities within our footprint. And then lastly, the risk posed by a malicious insider with access to information and kind of open control to grid operations is an ongoing concern. Next slide, Will. So I want to talk a little bit about MRO's top reliability risk, and our only extreme risk that we've identified. And that's around the uncertainty of whether we're going to have sufficient energy to meet the forecasted demand that's in front of us. And a major driver for that forecasted demand is the rapid growth of data center growth supporting artificial intelligence as well as the just overall digital economy. And the challenge here really comes down to timing. So you think about a data center, it can take anywhere from 2 to 3 years to build. But the natural gas generation fleet that is needed to support it can take 5 to 6 years. If you think about solar generation and storage, which is a rapidly evolving resource for the grid, that can take 3 to 5 years, you know, still longer than the data center can be developed. And then lastly, the transmission needs to serve those data centers, especially the extra high voltage transmission needs, can take 10 or more years to develop and put into service. And so truly, demand is arriving at a much faster pace than the infrastructure that we can build to serve it. And at the same time, we have existing generation resources that do continue to retire. Renewable resources are inherently variable. And then lastly, you think about data center load, that requires a around-the-clock 24/7 and very energy-intensive amount of load to be served. And we've also seen some recent events that really have shown how tight system conditions can and have become. So in 2025, there were actually two localized events in the southern portion of our footprint in Louisiana and Texas that showed, basically required the grid operators in those regions to have their operators initiate a controlled load shed to maintain the system reliability in those regions. And both of those events happened in kind of outside that traditional peak loading period that you normally see in the summer. And they were both driven by both planned and unplanned outages of transmission equipment and generation equipment. And the reason I bring these up is these were localized events, you know, to those kind of sub-regions of our footprint, but it does highlight how constrained our grid conditions have become. You know, margins are very tight. And the concern is if those margins continue to expand to a much broader portion of our footprint, we will see much larger impacts from those types of events. And I'll end here just on, you know, what do we do about it? How do we address this particular high priority, extreme priority risk? One is the way we plan our resource mix has to account for more than just the frequency of an energy shortfall. It needs to account also for the duration of that shortfall, as well as the amount of energy that we can't serve because we lack the resources. And then secondly, the planning horizon that we use to plan not only generation resources but transmission resources as well needs to expand and extend much further into the future. And we also have to consider a much wider range of potential scenarios because there is a lot more uncertainty in that planning process. And then lastly, the generation retirements that we're seeing need to be paced, and they need to be paced based on the replacement capacity that's being added, as well as the projected load growth that's being seen. And for our part, the Aero Enterprise, NERC, Midwest Reliability Organization, we have actually been incorporating these what we call energy adequacy metrics into our assessments, which take us away from that capacity-based, frequency-based planning to more of a duration and energy, unserved energy planning. And we've done that in our latest, what we call long-term reliability assessment. So if you go to the next slide, Will. We actually have some data from the latest, what we call LTRA for short. This report was actually published in January of this year. And it evaluates a 10-year outlook on the risk of energy shortages across North America. And I want to be clear on this. This analysis is not a prediction of the future, right? It is a kind of risk-based approach, and it's showing what could happen if the modeled conditions materialize. And so right now the model conditions are kind of dictated by information that's provided to us by regional transmission organizations, RTOs. Those would be MISO and SPP within our region. And the data that they're providing is showing summer peak demand growing by over 224 gigawatts in the next 10 years. And that's a 24% increase over even just last year's 10-year outlook. And that's a massive amount of energy. As you can see on the right graph, you can kind of see those past forecasts from those past assessments. And really you start to see that inflection point or that deflection point happening in our 2024 LTRA from 2 years ago, where you really saw the effect of the demand center growth get into the load forecast. Prior to that, you were seeing very, very modest growth to continue that modest growth that we've probably seen for the last two decades. So this has been a fundamental shift within the last couple of years. And I'll also add on this slide at the bottom, we're seeing a trend in resource additions lagging behind what was being projected at the time we did the assessment. And that's especially the case on the left-hand side graph, which is our dispatchable fleet, what we call non-variable. So we're seeing a gap in the expectations for what generation is going to be added or expected to be added to the grid and what actually has been added. So if we look at last year alone, 2025, there was a 27-gigawatt gap in what we thought was going to be there and available to provide energy and versus what actually was. And so that's concerning when you, again, have this rapid growth in load that we're seeing. When we look at, let's see.
In your modeling, so just going back to that slide, 2025, so there you said that 27-gigawatt gap. What made up for that? So, like, in your past, so those are past guesstimations that you thought would be online. What did you put in place for those that, you know, I'm sure you had either a technology or a, you know, what made that up?
Yeah, so I think the trend has been, and I think continues to be, you know, the margins that we have enjoyed for years because of that modest load growth have just continually have been getting eroded away. Mm-hmm. And so it's not so much that gap needed to be, you know, made up. It's, because we were still serving the energy needs, but that margin and being able to do so has been narrowing. And that really has created a much more complex and additional challenges in operating the grid. I obviously think about the more margin you can have, the more flexibility you end up having, especially when you start talking about those extreme conditions.
Certainly. Was that, you know, one of the stories I've heard was even just as late 2025 was that rather than using kind of in front of the pole generation to make up that gap, we utilize a lot of behind the pole generation. So relying on, you know, data centers do have a lot of backup power, calling on them to shut down their draw and actually generate their own. Did you see that? That was kind of that's now continually making across the country, really, that kind of behind the pole generation is making that gap up rather than kind of the stuff in the public space.
Sure. Yeah, and our assessment does take into account some of those what we call load modifying measures, where you have contracts where, individual load customers will decide to, you know, reduce their output at critical times. But it does not account for those emergency actions. You know, so those actions to run, you know, behind the meter on-site diesel generators to offset your load aren't included in our assessment.
It's not. Okay.
It's not.
Okay.
Correct.
All right. Thank you.
Anything that requires any emergency, well, in that case, emergency action order action to alleviate environmental constraints, which is what those are for, those aren't included.
Okay.
Yep. Yeah, if you go to the next slide there, Will. So I want to highlight, you know, this is the image, some of you may have seen. This is what really gets into the news, you know, the map you see here. And what this is really showing is that again, that modeled risk within our LTRA. And it's determined by a couple of factors. One is we do a comparison against the anticipated generating resources to that reference margin level I talked about earlier, you know, that eroding margin. But then we also take this probabilistic all hours energy adequacy approach, and we assess that for the years 2027 and 2029 within this assessment. And that's ultimately what results in this, result. So what you're seeing here, though, is the MISO footprint is indicated as a high risk for an energy shortfall starting in the year 2028. And that's in particular due to projected resource additions not keeping pace with the demand, expected demand additions that we're seeing, especially again with data centers, but as well as the announced generator retirements within the MISO footprint. Mm-hmm. And I'll point out, MISO does have an expedited resource addition study, ERAS, that they've gotten approved, I think, within the last, fourth quarter of 2025. Okay. That process and that expedited generation capacity that is expected to be added was not included in our assessment because of timing. The data we got for this assessment was received to us back in July. And we did identify in our report that if that generator does come to the system on time, it would alleviate a lot of the risk within the MISO footprint by that year 2028.
Do you know which one those are?
We don't have the specific generator sites. It's more the pool of what's within that expedited queue that MISO has in general. But you also see from this slide the SPP footprint, so the southern area, I guess it's southern and western area of the MISO or MRO footprint, is at a significant risk of shortfall. And that's starting even this year. And that's due to demand forecasts outpacing additions again. And then also SPP in particular is very vulnerable to wind conditions. Coupling a low wind period with a extreme weather period that might see increased levels of dispatchable generation that may be forced offline is where they see their highest level of risk. And again, I'll just remind everyone, these are not predictions. These are modeled outlooks, but they do highlight, again, where we have this margin that's narrowing. Go to the next slide, Will. And I'll just kind of hit on that point one more time real quick, just on kind of what's needed. That 224 gigawatts that I talked about in the next 10 years of addition and load. What does that look like from a resource addition standpoint? And so from our LTRA, we are seeing approved additions of generation resources falling well short of projected summer and winter load demand growth. And that's depicted by those solid bar graphs you see there on the right, the left one being summer and the right set being winter. Now, the positive thing is prospective generation, so generation that hasn't gotten through the approval process, will eclipse this demand growth for the summer season, and that's kind of depicted by that hashed portion of the bar. The concern, though, is in the winter, you're seeing even prospective generation growth is not enough to meet the expected winter demand growth in the next 10 years. Winter is presenting the greater reliability challenge going forward over summer. Next slide, Will. And so speaking of winter, we'll talk about that now. Extreme cold weather events have probably been the most significant widespread outages that we've seen in recent history. Back in 2021, Winter Storm Uri caused 4.8 million electric customers in the state of Texas to lose power. And that was power that was, again, operator-driven to maintain grid reliability. And those outages were driven by failures of generation as well as fuel constraints and, again, required that operator-initiated load shedding. Since that event in 2021, there's been a lot of progress made on this particular risk. NERC, for its part, has implemented a set of mandatory reliability standards around winterization for generators, and that's ultimately expected to improve that performance overall. However, that being said, with the increased reliance on natural gas generation that we're seeing, that's putting a lot more pressure on the natural gas infrastructure to be able to maintain the fuel supply to those resources. And go to the next slide, Will. And just to put some data to this challenge and this risk, you know, we did just have a fairly significant winter storm event, Winter Storm Fern, which hit our footprint as well as to the east on January 23rd through the 26th of this year. And what we've kind of found from that storm, as well as going even back as far to the Winter Storm Uri, when you look at these donut charts, is that dispatchable resources, your coal plants, your natural gas plants, and your nuclear plants, do remain essential during these extreme winter events. And you're also seeing that natural gas generation is representing a much bigger portion of that pie during the winter. And that's largely due to retirements of coal plants in recent years. And I'll also highlight, specific to the SPP footprint, wind generation for Winter Storm Fern did provide a meaningful contribution to not only their footprint, but it also allowed them to export some of that wind power to their neighbors during what was a very critical time, you know, for energy use. So there are some positives for Fern where that wind generation did show up in that footprint. And then overall, like I mentioned about generation fleet performance, it has generally improved since Winter Storm Uri, but there are still challenges that remain. We did hear reports of availability challenges in generation during Fern. Both MISO and SPP, for their parts, did an effective job with their conservative operations procedures to manage through the Winter Storm Fern event. But I will mention that MISO did declare its second highest level of emergency on January 24th, and that was ultimately to get access to emergency generation as well as deploy some load modifying resources to reduce the demand during that period, just so they can maintain system reliability. And I'll go to the next slide, Will. I do want to talk a little bit about MRO's program. So we have a voluntary generator winterization program, and this predated those mandatory reliability standards. And this program helps our entities improve their performance during extreme cold weather. And this program conducts either surveys or site visits of plants, and we are identifying vulnerabilities those plants have to winterization, mm-hmm. as well as suggesting effective measures on how they can improve their overall performance. And in the 5 years we've had this program, we've assessed over 50 different sites across our footprint. And we've also published a regional findings report last year that highlights lessons learned from each of those site visits and surveys, and really shared that with a broader set of generator owners for their benefit. And the goal here with this program is continuous improvement so that the generators within our footprint can be prepared for that next extreme event.
What primarily did you find? So, like, as you're creating that from that 50 site visits, kind of, and you're kind of essentially creating a best practices for other generators, what did that look like?
Yeah, it runs the gamut of things, you know, but it's you know, basically any equipment that you have that's exposed to below freezing temperatures, you're going to need to protect via, you know, a multitude of factors, whether you're braking, potential wind impact from hitting that equipment to make it colder, as well as heat tracing. You know, you're actually heating that, you're, you know, maintaining a heat source to that equipment so it can maintain the flow of whether it's a liquid or some sort of air component. It was probably a large source of a lot of those challenges. It's as simple as things as in the summertime you might have, you know, airflow that's running through your plant to keep it cooler because you might be dealing with warmer temperatures in that season. It's making sure that those are closed during the winter season so you're not letting that cold air just run through your plant. And I just want to end today on our kind of newly elevated risk, which is the availability of critical electrical equipment. And utilities across our footprint and across North America are planning major investments in transmission and generation to not only replace aging infrastructure, but also expand the transmission grid, in particular to support these new generation and new demand growth needs. If you look at MISO and SPP specifically, both of those regions are planning 765 kV transmission infrastructure to support this growing demand. And that's a voltage level that we have not seen within this region before. And at the same time, you have these hyperscale data centers that are competing for those same resources, those same pieces of equipment to support their growth as well. And that's constraining our manufacturing capacity and supply chain to get that equipment on time when it's needed to not only serve the growing grid, but also maintaining the existing grid. And lead times for that equipment remain at historical high levels. And so the concern here, and it plays into our extreme risk, you know, without improved availability of equipment, without being able to produce more of this critical equipment, we are going to constrain the generation and transmission expansion that we need to serve, again, these growing demands and the growing needs of the system, which will further heighten ultimate risk. And I'll close with this, you know, members of the committee. The reliability of our grid is truly not an abstract issue. It underpins public safety, economic growth, and ultimately national competitiveness. And our risk assessment, MRO's risk assessment, does show three clear realities. First, demand is accelerating at a pace that I don't think we've ever seen, that's largely driven by data centers. Second, our generation fleet is transforming at a very similar fast pace, and dispatchable resources are retiring, and replacement resources for those retiring resources are not arriving as quickly as they need to support, again, that demand growth. And winter reliability is in particular the more challenging season than other seasons during the year. And then lastly, the infrastructure of development in general, generation and transmission development, is not keeping pace with the growth either. Now, the good news is we have some time to act on all these things. I don't want to be the bearer of all bad news. But reliability does depend on alignment, and that alignment between retirements of resources and what we're replacing those resources with. It requires alignment between electric and natural gas entities, again, for that winter risk, as well as alignment between the build timelines for infrastructure and load growth. And then lastly, we do need alignment between technical planning and public policy. Thoughtful policy decisions that support timely infrastructure development, realistic planning horizons, fuel assurance, as well as equipment supply resilience will materially reduce risk to the grid. And then lastly, going back to our reliability as a team sport adage, reliability is a shared responsibility, and MRO is going to continue to identify and prioritize these top risks so that our grid operators and utilities can continue to strengthen their systems and their planning to address those risks. And we also see policymakers playing a critical role here in ensuring that conditions exist, you know, for the system to keep pace with the pace of change that we're seeing right now. And our message ultimately is simple. The grid is strong today, and it remains strong, but those margins that we talked about earlier are tightening. And proactive decisions are needed to determine whether we can stay ahead of this rapid pace of change or whether we're going to be forced to react to it. So thank you very much.
Sounds good. Are there any questions for Mr. Seifert or T. Meyer? Representative Macklin.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Kind of a little bit off topic, but in looking at the inside of your thing, the first picture here, these, I don't know what these large structures that hold these lines, have you ever seen these come down in bad storms like tornadoes?
Yeah, so actually.
Mr. T. Meyer.
Oh, sorry about that, Chair. I jumped too quickly to answer questions. In my past, so I've worked for the MRO for 4 years, but prior to that, I worked for Xcel Energy for 15 years, and actually I led their Transmission Control Center, which was the department that basically had operators sitting in a control room 24/7 to monitor and control the bulk power system for Xcel. And so I have extensive experience with system events that have occurred, and absolutely, since this infrastructure is, you know, exposed to the elements, structures do get damaged and can fail during extreme storms like tornadoes.
Representative Macklin.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I think we've all seen like a utility pole, if a car or a truck hits one, you know, they can get out there with relatively quick timing and replace it. How long would it take to put one of these back up, or like the ones that are along 94, they're, I think they're round bases, but they're very tall and they hold multiple lines. Like what would the time frame be to get one of those back up and so that the power could start flowing again?
Sure.
Mr. T. Meyer.
I'll speak a little bit outside of my current role at MRO. I'll kind of go back to my history and past just to help answer the question. For structures like the one you see here, or the structures where you might see a singular steel pole with a concrete base, you know, those are all custom designed and built and installed. And so to replace it for like, it would take the time to basically reproduce that structure again to get it in service. That being said, most utilities do have temporary structures and things that they'll put in place to restore that equipment to service while they wait for the ultimate solution to get built. And so that usually is in the form of some sort of wood structure because that's readily available to utilities. And I think every situation is going to be different as far as how quickly it can be repaired and returned to service. But it would not require the manufacturing of a new pole.
Representative Mekland.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. The reason I ask, I believe it was in 2024, am I correct on that, Chair Aiken? When last time Xcel presented their IRP, I think it was 2024. Okay. So in that, though, they said that they were going to be running a high-voltage transmission line south. They didn't really get explicit as to where, but it kind of like the Nebraska, Missouri, somewhere in that general. They gave a mile as how far down, and shortly after that, maybe a month or so, there was a very significant storm that went through like the southern Iowa, northern Nebraska area that was had created a lot of devastation. I got to thinking back then, like how long would it take to restore something like this if it went down and that was a significant feed coming to Minnesota? That's my concern, and you guys do this risk assessment. So I was just curious. I've never asked a question, so I'm just curious if you guys know the how long could you potentially be down in that scenario?
Mr. T. Meyer? Or?
Yeah, well, I mean, I think it kind of highlights that final risk I talked about with the availability of equipment materials. Again, there's a level of inventory that utilities are going to maintain to address storm events like that. And, of course, they're not trying to protect against the storm of the century in those cases. But with the constrained ability to produce and provide that equipment, there is risk of the response time to events like that lengthening. And that is concerning from a reliability standpoint, right? Because the more equipment that you don't have available to serve its purpose, again, the more that margin tightens, the capacity tightens, and you're not able to serve all customers.
Representative Mekland? Chair Aiken.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Welcome back to committee, Mr. Seifert, with a new hat on. Welcome, Mr. T. Meyer. I have just a couple of questions in your presentation, which was really informative, so thank you. You talked about this extreme risk for energy availability, the uncertainty of energy availability and connecting it to data centers. And, you know, this conversation coupled with the last agenda item, are there recommendations about how large of a new load should go, should be included with an existing load or existing community that they're serving?
Mr. T. Meyer.
Yeah, MRO does not have any specific recommendations to that end. I mean, we rely upon, obviously, the utilities within our footprint, working with their planning, planning function to make those determinations on, where a large facility like that can be connected in a way that maintains reliability. And those are all very specific and localized, decisions that are much more detailed than the broad kind of assessments that we do at MRO.
Chair Aiken.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I appreciate that. I just think that with data centers and utilities that kind of have the obligation to serve, I think that we need to be looking at some of these loads of needs versus wants. And so, maybe that kind of analysis needs to be brought into this whole discussion of data centers. And I think, you know, you talked about data centers, and there was conversation about sometimes using the backup generation to fuel them. I think I'm heartened to see that the applications that have just come to Minnesota recently have very little diesel backup generation, because they're building variability into their model, and they have even some demand response aspects to their data centers. And so I think that not all will need to have, some will for sure, but not all will. And so I think that's a great aspect that data centers can bring to the table. My other question for you was about how it, within your risks here, you talked another about the supply chain, and wondering how some of the federal actions over the last year, whether it's tariffs, whether it's, you know, rolling back rebates, tax rebates or incentives, and even the extension of expensive coal contracts or plants that were slated to close, how is that impacting some of these risks and the level of risk?
For a risk-free question, Mr. Tiemeyer.
So there's a couple of things. I'll address the first one around the emergency orders, I think, for the coal plants. And from a reliability, and I'm speaking from a reliability's perspective, that's the chair I sit in, the delay of those retirements, and we actually saw this during Winter Storm Fern, and MISO even said this, you know, those plants did provide energy during those conditions. They maintain dispatchable generation in the grid, which if you look at some of the recommendations, actually even on this slide, where we talk about managing retirements, especially in consideration of replacement resources and load growth, we do see that as a reliability benefit, at least in the short term. I think longer term, you can question that. As far as the supply chain.
Well, can I respond to that quickly,
absolutely,
and ask you a follow-up question?
Representative Acom.
Sorry, Mr. Chair. Sorry. Thank you. I just want to then ask, how do you factor cost into your analysis, given the cost to the grid to the system for those extensions?
Mr. Tiemeyer.
Yeah. So as Mr. Seifert mentioned earlier, you know, we have that luxury of really only having to worry about that one leg of the stool, the reliability leg, but we do realize that reliability has a cost, and so we don't ignore that. So while we don't include the cost of that into our assessments, we do recognize, you know, that is a challenge, you know, for utilities and for the states as well to kind of maintain that balance.
Representative Sexton. Oh, sounds good. The supply chain one.
Yeah, on the supply chain one, and I'm not as well informed as maybe I should be on some of this with the supply chain, but again, we are challenged with these lead times. So to the extent that there are actions that are taking that are constraining, you know, getting you know, steel on site and in the ground, right, that is concerning. I don't have the details about the different actions and how that might impact that particular risk, but just in a general sense, we need more steel, we need more turbines, we need more and more and more. And so eliminating constraints to that is very, very important.
Chair Acom.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And then really just a follow-up and comment in that what I'm hearing you say is that the executive actions are adding risk to the system.
Mr. Tiemeyer.
Yeah, I guess what I could say is I'm not – we have not done that analysis, and so I'm not fully familiar with being able to make that assessment.
Representative Sexton.
Thank you, Chair. My question goes to your risk analysis model a little bit. You didn't talk about how you do risk analysis on renewables. I happen to be a survivor of Winter Storm Uri. I spent the week down there at 16 degrees in Houston, Texas, and it was not fun. So obviously they had a lot of wind generation that was not available, which is a huge concern, hopefully a huge lesson learned. How are we taking, like, nameplate wind generation, nameplate solar, and calculating that into the risk overall and availability, quite frankly?
Mr. Tiemeyer.
Yeah, great question. And really it's two ways. The first being just I'll call it the historical way of looking at resource adequacy and the risk of shortfalls. You know, we are taking input in from the RTOs, MISO and SPP, to those numbers. You know, what would they expect a solar plant to provide from a capacity standpoint for the most critical hours? Or what would be the capacity of a wind farm in those most hours? We take that data, and that gets put into our risk analysis as part of that LTRA. Now, beyond that, kind of the next step of that, and what we have now just started to introduce for ourselves, is, and it's that energy adequacy approach that we just instituted this year, is kind of a pilot, but it's going to continue on. And that's looking at an all-hours approach. And what that does is it looks at past weather years and the performance of those different asset characteristics of different generators, and it's going to bake that into a kind of Monte Carlo analysis that's looking at all the different potential futures, and it's applying an expected shortfall based on that. And so that will account for periods of low wind, it will account for periods of low solar generation, and will identify those periods of time when that might not be adequate to serve the needed energy that's projected.
Mr. Chair, Representative, if I could just add on too, I think if you see in this picture here, that's partly why you're seeing the gap in the winter, because we're derating those resources at the accreditation values that the RTOs use.
Right.
So solar, for example, that gets derated pretty significantly for winter performance.
Right.
We also do similar math with thermal generation. Based on the performance of thermal generators, you're not going to just put in that installed capacity number. You're going to mm-hmm. derate it based on how they've historically performed. So that's all kind of baked into here.
But, yeah, that's right. I'm putting a nameplate. If I can
yes.
add one more.
Representative Sexton.
So with the development of batteries, how is that changing the model, so to speak? Obviously, it's going to cushion it, but how much and how much do we see the growth being able to make up that derated nameplate in that condition you've already done on renewables?
Mr. Tiemeyer.
Yeah, we haven't done a specific analysis yet on batteries per se. It's kind of lumped in. But one thing I can say about batteries, the current technology that's being deployed for battery energy storage is lithium phosphate. It's got generally a four-hour discharge time frame. So you think about that battery, when it's fully charged, will have to discharge itself within 4 hours. So what that's going to fill is any four-hour gap, and when you don't have enough dispatchable resources and wind and solar to meet the energy need. And the challenge with that and with the existing technology, especially in winter conditions, which again is highlighting why that's such a concern for us going forward, is you're seeing what we call energy droughts or wind and solar droughts that expand past that four-hour time frame. And actually, Will, if you go back to the winter storm Fern slide.
Wait, which slide number is that, Mr.
There we go. Slide number, of course, the one we don't have a number on.
The one, 15.
Yeah, 15. I don't think any of them have numbers. There we go. But it's got the donut chart there for winter storm Fern performance. Because I think that it's a kind of a somewhat of a telling picture. It doesn't tell the full story. I have another chart that shows something slightly better for this. But you kind of look at the differences between the MISO and SPP footprints during winter storm Fern, especially when you look at the wind generation. So that's the yellow part of the internal. That's the orange part of that external donut. Wind supplied a significant amount of energy for SPP. For MISO, much different story. They had a lot less wind throughout winter storm Fern. And actually, on the day that MISO was calling their emergency alert, the level 2 alert, MISO had even less wind than what this is showing. And so that's kind of highlighting the risk you have for certain conditions where that resource doesn't show up. And the challenge with battery storage related to that is, do we have enough stored to cover that event for an entire day, for that example? And there's probably plenty of other examples where that other day, that day might be, can we do it for the next 2 or 3 days?
Well, it's also timing, because you're trying to use...
Representative Sexton.
Sorry, sir.
No, go ahead.
You end up using something that you really would use during the night when the sun's not available, but you're having to use it during the day when you're peaking out on your need. And so it just seems high risk to me.
Mr. Chair, Representative, I'll just add to that too. As an enterprise, we're learning a lot about this right now. There's not a lot of penetration of batteries in this region, so we're probably not the experts to talk to you about battery storage. What I can say is in Texas and in California, there have been a lot of success stories in how it's been used and it's been integrated into the grid, but those are different climates. They have different rules for their grid operators, and so we'll continue to monitor this and share as we learn too. And
Representative Sexton, follow up.
Yes, sir.
All right, Representative Kraft.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Welcome back. First, just a comment. Representative Sexton brought up Winter Storm Uri in Texas. Look it up. The primary issue that caused the problem in Winter Storm Uri was the failure of the natural gas system there and the lack of winterization. Wind had some issues too, but not nearly to the extent of the gas system. They just hadn't winterized their stuff as much. They had a recent issue in the past, about 5 years since Winter Storm Uri, and the grid there performed a lot better. And the reasons that I'm reading that it did was they've got some batteries now, they've weatherized their stuff, and actually they've got a bunch more renewables that provided more energy that got them through it. So just wanted to mention that. We just talked about this issue in SPP territory, MISO. Wouldn't that issue have been helped with more transmission between the two?
Mr. Seifert.
Mr. Chairman, Representative. Yeah, I'm going to just provide a little bit of, first I want to comment on your first point. Nothing in this chart should be construed as an argument that somehow Winter Storm Uri was the cause of failing renewables. This was simply an illustrative point of two similar storms that had such a large swath of geographic impact, similar times, similar stresses. And so when we looked at how we performed in Fern, we wanted to have something to compare it to. So it was not an argument to suggest that wind was the cause of that. So I just want to clarify that for the record. On the transmission side, again, I'm not going to give you a straight line answer, but I will tell you, we recently completed the Interregional Transfer Capability Study called ITCS. This was a congressional requirement where we found that there was a reliability need for an addition of 33 gigawatts of transfer capability transmission. This is long-range transmission throughout the continent. So NERC and MRO strongly see the important value and recognize the importance, and the data is there. The transmission is a big component of that.
Representative Kraft.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Yeah, so I think recently the Trump administration canceled a transmission line between SPP and the MISO area, put some roadblocks in the way that doesn't seem to make sense in light of that. A question. How much do you model? I mean, this is really interesting. How much do you model variability of demand, right? Like the fact that we do want data centers to be flexible. As we go to more and more electrification, many of these things out there can actually shift their demand profile. How much do you model that?
Mr. Seifert or Mr. Tiemeyer?
I mean, Mr. Chairman, Representative, I can take a crack at it, and I'm sure Mark can jump in if I missed anything. That's a great question. And with data centers, there is introducing a level of uncertainty with these load forecasts that we are very aware of. For the actual production of the LTRA, we take an aggregate of the demand forecasts, the RTOs look at them, and we derate them to the effect that if there aren't underlying development agreements, we're not going to count them as part of that demand forecast, because we don't want that to. We understand there is some degree of speculation. There are a lot of things we don't know, and we want this to be as accurate as possible. On the supply side, we have a similar approach where we tier resources to try to ensure that we're comparing apples to apples, and that when we do the calculations to make sure we have the resources to meet the reserve margin, we're looking at things that we have a high degree of confidence are going to be there. So back to your question on demand, we're evolving our approach to this. We are, the ERO enterprise is looking at changes to how we tier demand to also try to be a little bit more precise. Because at the end of the day, I want to reinforce, these risk assessments, these reliability assessments, these are not predictions, okay? These are projections. These are identifications of risk. Your cardiologist doesn't tell you you're going to have a heart attack on August 23rd of, you know, 2034. They say you have some risk factors, and these are things you can do to think about how you manage those risk factors. We want this assessment to be understood in that same context. We, you know, we're not going to comment on what federal actions are good or bad. We are, though, very pleased that decision makers are looking at this information and utilizing it to inform their decisions. And we hope that states do the same thing.
Representative Kraft.
And these are, sorry to ramble on. And we do these are great questions because I think it really does help inform your understanding.
Representative Kraft.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chair. Yeah, we're nerding out on grid stuff, so I'll stop.
Oh, we're all nerding.
Well, so here's a comment I want to make. Look, there's extreme weather, by the way, caused by climate change, is causing more issues on our infrastructure where you could see things like those big transmission wires going down that we maybe wouldn't have expected as much in the past. The evolution of the type of electric demand with data centers, with all these other kinds of things, are also changing. And so and I appreciate the modeling, and I think what we need to get to, I mean, there's a couple ways to deal with it, right? You can say, look, let's build a whole bunch more coal plants and gas plants that are always on and build to the peak and, you know, pollute the heck out of the environment and raise costs to everyone, and that'll solve it, right? I don't think we want to do that. And this is where the variable nature that we need to see in demand. So I would love to see, you know, one of the solutions should be 25% of our demand needs to be flexible, needs to be variable. And if you build that into the models and then we work towards that, then that has a quite different picture. So thank you.
Okay. Any closing comments?
I'll just address
ahead,
that really quick.
Go ahead, Mr. Giemeier.
Yeah, I'll address that really quick around kind of what we build into our models for variability of data center demand. So we rely upon the, you know, again, the MISOs and the SPPs to tell us the amount of their demand mix that has a load response, right? And for them to tell us that a data center can, you know, change its demand based on conditions, they would have to have some sort of contractual agreement to do that for us. So currently in our modeling, we don't include that because, well, we only include it to the extent that a MISO or an SPP tell us and that there is some sort of confirmed agreement. And for a lot of these, I'll call them prospective data centers, the load growth that we're seeing, they're not to far enough along where those types of contracts have been put in place, essentially, which, again, creates more uncertainty.
Representative Kraft, just for a follow-up.
Just really clarification. I was talking about variability of demand, period, not of data centers on their own.
Yeah, Mr. Chairman, Representative. Just to clarify, if, as my colleague was saying, and the same thing holds on transfers, if they are under contract and the RTO can verify when they need those 50 megawatts, they have a contract that they're going to show up, then they're counted. If they don't have that certainty, we don't count it in the LTRA because, again, we want to make sure we understand that risk profile and don't want to make the assumption that power is simply going to be there available to move if maybe the wind is also not blowing in another region. And that's not an argument for or against one specific resource. What it is it's an argument of why we do these assessments and try to isolate 8760 throughout the entire continent so decision makers like yourself can find that threshold that you want to build the system to, that you're comfortable with your constituents paying for, because reliability does have a price. We recognize that. And there are a lot of things, where I started from, there are a lot of things you guys have to balance. We want to be able to be a resource on reliability and how you understand that part of the equation.
All right. We want to thank you for coming before the committee. I'm sure you'll be available for more in-depth questions as we just kind of did all the light stuff today here in committee. And appreciate your time. Thank you. Representative
Mr. Chair, thanks.
Collins. So the next bill on the agenda is House File 3802. Representative Hollins, please make your way to the testifiers table and move your bill when you're ready. If you have any testifiers that are ready to roll, if they could join you at the table so we can be studious with people's time here.
Thank you so much, Chair Szczesinski, and thank you, Chair Akam, and members. I would move that HF 3802 be referred to the General Register.
Representative Holland moves that House File 3802 be referred to the General Register. Representative Holland, would you like to move by the A1 amendment?
I would, sir.
All right. Representative Holland moves the A1 amendment to get the bill in the shape that she would like. Is there any discussion to the amendment? All right. All in favor to the A1 amendment, say aye.
Aye.
All opposed? The ayes have it. All right. Representative Holland, to your bill as amended.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. The A1 amendment represented the Great River Energy agreement with stakeholders, including the PUC, Department of Commerce, and environmental organizers. This bill is fairly simple. As amended, it is a narrowly tailored exemption from the certificate of need requirement for certain transmission line upgrades. Electricity demands are growing, particularly in Greater Minnesota, and utilities are trying to keep up with the need by upgrading their transmission lines. Under current law, these line upgrades would require a whole new certificate of need, despite the fact that they're generally not being installed on new structures or new right-of-ways. Requiring a whole new certificate of need process can delay these upgrades for at least 1 year and significantly increase costs, which may potentially then be passed on to ratepayers. The goal of this bill is to streamline the process of line upgrades across the state when they have minimal new impact on the communities they serve. And I've got testifiers.
All right.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members.
Would you introduce yourself to the committee?
Absolutely. Thank you, Mr. Chair, and members of the committee. For the record, my name is Stacey Fujii. I'm the Director of Governmental Affairs for Great River Energy. As members know, Great River Energy is a generation and transmission cooperative. We are owned by our 26 distribution cooperatives. Together, we serve approximately 1.7 million Minnesotans and serve about two-thirds of the geographical area of the state of Minnesota. First of all, we want to thank Representative Hollins for agreeing to chief author this bill and shepherd it through the process. Also want to thank Chair Szczesinski, Representative Igo, and Representative Long for being co-authors on the bill as well. As Representative Hollins has indicated, House File 3802 represents a narrow exemption to the certificate of need process. We're talking about rebuilds generally under 100 kV, so generally we're talking about 69 kV lines that exist, and upgrading those to capable of operating at 115 kV. This is a narrow exemption of existing rebuilds or existing lines that we will rebuild, and we hope, we believe this is falls in line with the current list of exemptions in statute. So for members who are newer to the committee and the process, when we construct new or rebuild existing facilities, we go through two regulatory processes at the Public Utilities Commission. First, there is the certificate of need process. That's the why. Is this facility needed? If we successfully prove the why and the certificate of need and are granted a certificate of need, then we go through the routing process. House File 3802 only impacts the certificate of need process. We don't touch the routing process. And so for, it always helps to have a visual. So for members, there in your packet is a very nicely logo GRE picture to give you an idea of what we're talking about. So the facility on the left is generally speaking, a 69 kV line, and the facility on the right is a 115 kV line. So that's the difference that we're talking about. So with that, that exhausts my knowledge. I'm going to turn it over to my colleague, Dan Lesher, who will be able to explain why we think this is a needed exemption.
Mr. Lesher, if you'd like to introduce yourself to the committee, and we look forward to your testimony.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. My name is Dan Lesher, and I'm the Manager of Transmission, Permitting, and Land Rights for Great River Energy. In Minnesota, there are about 8,500 miles of 69 kilovolt transmission lines, roughly 44% of all transmission miles in the state. The average lifespan of a transmission line is about 65 years. At Great River Energy, we operate over 3,000 miles of transmission under 100 kilovolts, and 60% of those miles average 55 years of age, nearing the end of their reliable life. The bill before you, as you've heard, is narrowly focused. It would provide an exemption for the certificate of need for rebuilds of existing 69 kilovolt lines to 115 capable structures with at least 80% of the line remaining in the current right-of-way. A 115 kilovolt line looks very similar to a 69 kilovolt line. It requires a similar height, a similar right-of-way width, and similar cost components, but has double the capacity. This proposal strikes a practical balance. The purpose of this bill is straightforward: maintain reliability, keep costs affordable, and streamline the permitting process in situations where the need for the line is already clearly established. These lines have been in place for decades. Communities rely on them. Rebuilding them efficiently and providing for future grid flexibility serves the public interest. Importantly, this legislation does not eliminate public input. Route permits are still required, public engagement requirements remain intact, and landowners will continue to be notified as part of our rebuild process. We believe House File 3802 provides a narrow exemption to the Certificate of Need law. We hope the committee can support it. Thank you, and I'm here to answer any questions.
Sounds good. Do we have any questions from members? I'd also like to remind, we do, in your packets, we have, I believe, a letter from SEEM and also from the Minnesota Conservative Energy Forum in your packets as their written testimony. No questions? Representative Hollins, your bill.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I would appreciate all your support. This is a common sense provision that I am happy to champion. And I'd like to renew my motion that House File 3802 be re-referred to the General Register.
Just going to pause that for 1 second. Is there anyone from the public that would like to testify on behalf of this bill? Sorry, I got a little ahead of myself. All right. All right. Representative Hollins renews her motion that House File 3802 be passed out of committee and onto the General Register. As amended, all in favor?
Aye.
All opposed? The ayes have it. You're on your way.
Thank you.
All right. Members, the next meeting is Tuesday, March 10th. Chair Aiken will have the gavel. All right. See you then. We are adjourned.